Hi there. Just a quick note that if you're hearing this, it means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed. I encourage you to become a Misfit right now and immediately unlock every single full-length episode that I've ever done, and you can immediately start learning from some of the greatest entrepreneurs in history. It is absolutely insane how much you can learn for such a small investment, but don't take my word for it. Let me just read a couple of the testimonials from Misfits. It says, I just paid for my first premium podcast subscription for Founders Podcast. Learning from those who came before us is one of the highest value ways to invest time. David does his homework and exponentially improves my efficiency by focusing on the most valuable lessons. Another person said, I stumbled upon this podcast. After one episode, I quickly joined the Misfit feed since $5 a month is the equivalent of a few cups of coffee for great detailed biographies on amazing leaders. I love the insights and thoughts shared along the way. David loves what he does and it shines through on the podcast. Definitely my go-to podcast now. And just one more before I get into today's preview. It is worth every penny. I cannot put into words how fantastic this podcast is. Just stop reading this and get the full access now. I agree with every single one of them, obviously. I hope you do as well. If you do, tap the link that's in the show notes on your podcast player or go to founderspodcast.com. It takes less than a minute to set up and you can start learning from some of the greatest minds in history. Phil very much wanted to go to the farm for a break from the hospital and had started to work on the doctors to obtain their permission. There was a sharp difference of opinion among the doctors about whether this was a good idea, but no one ever asked me if there was liquor or sleeping pills at the farm, nor did I think to mention the guns we had there. I, who certainly knew the farm was stocked with guns that Phil used for sport, was completely deluded by his seeming progress, lack of visible depression, and his determination to get well. In fact, I was optimistic about his ability to do so, and I must say I was glad. He wanted so much to go to the farm, and I got caught up in thinking how good it would be for him. On Saturday, August 3rd, Phil's driver picked him up, and then they came to get me. We had lunch on the back porch while chatting and listening to some classical records. After lunch, we went upstairs to our bedroom for a nap. After a short while, Phil got up, saying he wanted to lie down in a separate bedroom that he sometimes used. A few minutes later, there was the ear-splitting noise of a gun going off indoors. I bolted out of the room and ran around in a frenzy looking for him. When I opened the door to a downstairs bathroom, I found him. It was so profoundly shocking and traumatizing. He was so obviously dead, and the wounds were so ghastly to look at that I just ran into the next room and buried my head in my hands, trying to absorb that this had really happened. This dreadful thing that had hung over us for the last 6 years, which he had discussed with me and with his doctors, but which he had not been talking about in recent weeks, when he was obviously most seriously thinking about it. The sight had been so appalling that I knew I couldn't go back in. What I was agonizing about was that I had let him leave the bedroom alone. I can only say that he seemed so much better that I stupidly was not worried enough. It never occurred to me that he must have planned the whole day at the farm to get to his guns as a way of freeing himself forever from the watchful eyes of the doctors and the world. He left no note of any kind. And that was an excerpt from the book that I'm going to talk to you about today, which is Personal History, the Autobiography of Katharine Graham. Before I jump into the book, I want to tell you how I came to discover. I actually was listening to Jeff Bezos talk, and he actually, before he bought the Washington Post, which is the business that Katharine's now going to run after the suicide of her husband, he read this book. Said it was a fantastic book. It winds up going, won the Pulitzer, I think, in 1998. It's one of the highest reviewed books that I've ever come across, and I could see why. It was an absolute fantastic read. But so I heard Jeff Bezos say that later on when I was reading the biography of Warren Buffett, Snowball. I think I covered that on Founders number 100. Katharine Graham is I wouldn't say a main character, but she's in the book a lot. She's a supporting character in the biography of Warren Buffett. Because he makes an investment in the 1970s in the Post, and he becomes very close friend. Some say they had an affair, actually. of Katharine Graham. And so he talks in the biography, or I guess he's not the one writing it, but the author talks a lot about the relationship that Katharine Graham had. And it was in that book, Snowball, that I discovered the story of Katharine Graham, where she's in her 40s, she has four kids, she's married to Phil Graham. Her father had bought the Washington Post a couple decades earlier. At the time, there was very uncommon for women to be running large companies. In fact, Katharine Graham is the first ever CEO of a Fortune 500 company, a female CEO of a Fortune 500 company. But her father, when he's ready to retire, he actually passes the business. Instead of giving it to her, he gives it to her husband. And so her husband is running that up until the point that he commits suicide. So the reason I was interested in reading the book, besides Bezos obviously saying, hey, you should read this book, which is usually a good enough reason on its own, right, is I cannot imagine what that experience must have been like. She did not see this coming. I'll talk more about that as we get into the book. But this idea where you could be in your 40s, you know, not really have, at the time, it was she was involved in her family, civic activities, but did not have any business experience. Your husband kills himself. You discover it. You see the aftermath. And then now not only you have to take over the family company because no one else is there to run it while taking care of your kids and yourself. I just cannot imagine what that experience would be like. And so reading this book is my way of finding out what that experience is like. And I think the title, Personal History, is really interesting because this book is a large book. I have the paperback version. It's 625 pages. And what this feels like you're reading is her personal diary, where she goes into great detail of her life, mostly in chronological order. And it feels like the first note I left as I, you know, maybe 100 pages into the book, I was like, you know what, this book really does, it tells the inner monologue of someone that is not at all comfortable with herself and where she fits in with others. And that this refreshing honesty that I think most people hide might be the main reason to read the book. So let me go ahead and jump into the book right now. Okay, so this is a description of her early life. She says, as the fourth of five children, I was oddly shielded from the rigors of living with parents who demanded perfection and from some of the eccentricities of our curious upbringing. Luck helped me be a survivor and gave me strength. My difficulties were much more tied to a lack of guiding personal relationships, for I had more or less to bring myself up emotionally and figure out how to deal with whatever situations confronted me. So I'm going to talk about that in a minute because her mom's almost like, I would compare the way she presents her mom in this book to almost like the way like a Disney evil stepmother would be portrayed. Extremely selfish, egotistical, demeaning to the kids, even though they're her biological kids. Just not a good mother figure at all. At the same time, I was surrounded by extreme luxury. I led a life structured and in many ways Spartan, circumscribed by schools and lessons, travel and study. So it talks about, there's a lot going on in these two paragraphs. One is talking about demanding perfection. Her father was a very, very formidable person. He was an investor, an entrepreneur. By the time she is born, she was born in 1917. Her father had already accumulated a fortune somewhere around $40 to $60 million. So the equivalent of today, you know, that could be hundreds of millions, if not more. He was extremely wealthy, once being president of the World Bank. He has this, actually, I'm going to look for a biography on him because I found him such an interesting and intelligent person. But as many fathers during this time period, rather absent. He does develop a very close relationship with her, but he also just assumes that, you know, she's not going to be able to run a business, which is, you know, the way, unfortunately, women were looked at during this time period. And that's why he gravitated towards her husband instead of her. I would say that even though the father's busy, he's absent a lot, as you could imagine, I think he was the better of the two parents. And so I want to talk a little bit of her mom, who, you know, I didn't, based on the descriptions that Katharine has in the book, just not a good person. A lot of this book has just amazed at how many letters between the family that they saved. There's a lot of written material in here. And in this one case, she's writing, I think, to a friend. Her mother's writing to a friend talking about, I don't even know if she ever wanted to be a mom. She's talking, listen to the sentence. She's talking about the difference of having between having two or three kids. She was distressed at the difficulties of three, meaning children, as opposed to two children, comparing them to a basket of eels. Now, I don't think her mother was a bad person. I think she led an interesting life, but she was just focused on her own life. And I think part of being a good family member, just like being a good friend, is you have to have some level of selflessness, right? You can't just be selfish. That doesn't mean that she wasn't intelligent, that she couldn't pass along a lot of wisdom to her children. This is, in my opinion, this is going to come from the diary of her mother when she's mountain climbing in the Canadian Rockies in 1926. And this is a lesson, in my opinion, the best lesson that her mother could teach her, which is don't quit. You can do more than you think you can. And I think that's really important to tell Catherine that, because Catherine was she had a very low self-esteem. Interesting enough, Warren Buffett is going to play a major role, and I'm going to talk a lot about him today. She credits him with actually being the one to make her believe in herself, which is very interesting how he did it. And this is not the Warren Buffett we think of today. The Warren that we're going to talk about today is mainly in 1970, so this is like 50-year-old Warren. But he's got a lot of good advice, just like he, 90-year-old Warren does as well. But this is, first before I get there, this is the excerpt from her mother's diary. The fatigue of the climb was great, but it is interesting to learn once more how much further one can go on one second wind. I think that this is an important lesson for everyone to learn, for it should also be applied to one's mental efforts. I couldn't agree more. Most people go through life without ever discovering the existence of that field of endeavor which we describe as a second wind. Whether mentally or physically occupied, most people give up at the first appearance of exhaustion. So I talked about this last week. I feel we talk about this over and over again. One of the benefits of reading biographies and autobiographies is you realize that they have troubles just like you and I do. The difference is they don't quit. Whereas most of our peers, most of our colleagues, most of the people that we interact with don't have that. Most humans in history don't have that. We give up way too easily, and that's what our mother's saying. Whether mentally or physically occupied, most people give up at the first appearance of exhaustion. Thus, they never learn the glory and the exhilaration of genuine effort. That is a fantastic lesson that our parents could instill in us, and that's what she's doing right there. And using the analogy of climbing a mountain and how physically difficult that was, and using and how you can apply what you learn from exhausting yourself physically to obviously mental and your professional life and everything else. Okay, so this next section is her right at the end of high school. There's a ton of paragraphs spread throughout the entire years. I don't think she felt completely comfortable with who she was till she was probably 50, maybe 60 years old. So it says, apparently my classmates didn't see me the way I saw myself. My class prophecy read, Kay's a big shot in the newspaper racket. But I envisioned no such future for myself, or in fact, any specific future at all. Rather than creating my own way, what I was trying to do all the time was figure out how to adjust to whatever life I found. And a few pages later, we see another paragraph where it continues to expound on the main theme of this book, which is she has a serious lack of self-esteem, which I think people would find surprising given how much she had later accomplished in her life. I thought, realistic about my own assets. I hate that word, realistic, that is. I thought realistic about my own assets and abilities as I grew older. I was not very pretty. I seemed ungainly to myself. I didn't think I could excel. And I was sure I'd never attract a man whom I would like and who would not be viewed with condescension by my parents and siblings. So that echoes back to what she was saying. Her parents had, and her entire family had, extremely high standards or high expectations of everybody else. But this is just very distressing. This idea that she talks about it, she says it might have been on a subconscious level, but she was taught that her role in life is to find a man, get him to marry you, and then raise the children and be happy and content and in your life doing that, but to not have any desire to excel professionally. And I think, obviously, now we live in a world that's much different than that, albeit not perfect, but this idea where, 50% of human beings alive were taught not to try to fulfill their potential, I think is devastating. So also spread throughout the book is just some advice that her father, and this is as they start to grow, as she got older, they start to grow closer. And this is just a great quote from her father. When others, he had already purchased the Washington Post at this point. It's really a passion project for him. It's something he wanted to keep in his family to pass down to generations. And that's exactly what wound up happening. But this is just a quote: when others are predicting that he's going to fail, trying to resurrect the Washington Post, and he didn't have that belief at all. And he says, when an idea is right, nothing can stop it. That's one of my favorite sentences in the entire book. Now, something that's interesting to me and why I wanted to start the podcast with Phil's suicide, that's Phil Graham, her husband's suicide, is because I feel that was the line of demarcation in her life. She's, you know, in her 40s at the time, she lives to 84, so it's roughly the halfway mark of her life as well. And I feel the first 40 years of her life were more unhappy. I don't think she knew who she was as a person. I don't think she was living the life that she actually wanted to. And something I found really interesting is, you know, we see excerpts from her diary when she's much younger. She worked at newspapers before she got married. She had a deep love of the newspaper industry and the Post. And that's what I'm going to read to you here real quick. Let me read the paragraph first, and I'll leave the note I left myself because I wasn't sure what was taking place at this point in the book. So it says, much later, the depth of my caring was pointed out to me by Phil's psychiatrist, who told me that Phil and I both had a problem. We cared too much about the Washington Post. I told him, in one of the great understatements of my life, that I feared there was little he could do about that. So and the Washington Post, when she starts to run it, and she runs it up, and, you know, she's heavily involved up until she dies, even though her son winds up taking over after her. But that was the deep love of her life. She never gets remarried. She becomes married to her career. And I think that's secretly what she wanted her entire life, but she was told that you shouldn't want that. Do you see what I mean here? Where it's almost like she's willing to let others dictate how her life should go. And again, one of my favorite ideas, it might be my favorite idea that I learned in that book, The Snowball, which is where I was introduced to Katharine Graham, is this idea of how Warren Buffett describes it. It's the difference between an inner and an outer scorecard. So he talks about he admired his father because he had an inner scorecard, meaning that he chose what his life was going to be. And if people didn't agree or they didn't think he'd succeed, that's fine. As long as he was comfortable with the results of his own thinking. And if he wanted to pursue something, even if others made fun of him or thought it would fail, it didn't matter. His mom, who Warren Buffett was, I would say, almost terrified of, was the opposite, the outer scorecard. She was worried about what others would think of her. Others would think of her family if Warren got in trouble or whatever the case was. And Warren, I think, correctly arrives at the conclusion that if you want to have a happy life, you have to be dictated by your inner scorecard. And if you want to be miserable, you should go after an outer scorecard, right? Be so concerned with other people think that it kind of dulls who you are as a person. I would say the first half of her life, Katharine Graham definitely has an outer scorecard. I don't know if she ever completely switched over to an inner scorecard up until right before she dies. She talks about there's a lot of negatives of aging, but one of the benefits is, you know, you don't have worry. You're finally free to do what you really want to do. Unfortunately, at that point where she realizes that she only has about 4 or 5 more years left. But going back to this part about caring deeply, which is so bizarre to me, why she just accepted her father's decision to not just to give it to Phil, not even think about her. So the note I left myself is, when does this deep love for the Post begin? And the reason I wrote that is because now looking back, I highly suspect she always had that deep love, but she buried it because it was such a remote possibility in her mind. I don't have the skills. I can't run a business. I can't do anything. This is what men do. And I think, again, that's just a devastating way to live your life. Okay, so right after college, she's working in the newspaper industry, and she gets advice from her father. And so it's something that she's writing about 60 years after it happened. And I thought it was really good advice, so I want to read it to you as well. My father wrote me back at once, thanking me for my letter and concluding with what is one of the simplest and best precepts for parents to live by that I have ever read. It meant a lot to me then, as it does even today. What parents may sometimes do, and this is now her father writing to her, what parents may sometimes do in a helpful way is to point out certain principles of action. I do not think I would be helpful in advising you too strongly. I do not even feel the need of doing that because I have so much confidence in your having really good judgment. The way her father talks to her is completely different than the way her mother does. Her mother would diminish her accomplishments, make her, Catherine seem that she wasn't as smart as her mom was, wasn't as driven, so on and so forth. So I really appreciate what her father's saying here. Let me go back to what he was saying. I have so much confidence in you for having really good judgment. I believe that what I can do for you once in a while is to point out certain principles that have developed in my mind as sound and practical, leaving it for you yourself to apply them if your own mind grasps and approves those principles. That's fantastic advice. It's really interesting now that I reread that section, knowing what happens later on in the book. She is taught, Warren Buffett essentially gives her a one-on-one course in how to run a business. Can you imagine being mentored on a one-on-one basis from Warren Buffett, who his entire life has been about, I don't know if there's anybody alive today that has studied and read and learned more about all the different businesses. It was extremely helpful. But what happened is, and something that her father's saying here that Warren also echoes later, is she started to become too reliant on it. Like, she'd call him 2, 3, 4 times a day with just basic questions. And at one point, they're thinking of, the Washington Post company is very different from just running the Washington Post. They own radio stations and TV networks and other newspapers and all kinds of other stuff. It's a gigantic business, right? And they're about to buy, she wants to buy another, later on in the book, they talk about she wants to buy another newspaper. And she insisted that Warren be involved in the negotiations. And he refused at that point. He's like, you are competent enough. You can do it. I'm not going to do it for you. And that message to her was like, oh, that was extremely, it built her up. It gave her more confidence, and she wound up buying something at a good rate and wound up being a good deal, and they made money on it later on in life too. But I thought that was I think that's just very good advice from Warren and very good advice from her father. It's like, listen, I can teach you the lessons and the principles and the things I discovered over my long career, but unless they make sense in the context of your life, unless unless you understand them and then want to apply them, like, that's something no one can do for you. You have to apply them. You have to do that for your life. And I think that's just fantastic parenting. Okay, so now I want to tell you about, I'm going to read a couple excerpts from, this is a letter that she wrote in college. And this is what I was referencing earlier. She knows what she wants, but is full of doubt. And as I read this to you, this reminded me when I read this letter that she wrote. I saw a talk Kobe Bryant gave in China, and he was talking about what the biggest fear that we usually have in life is not things that are external. It's internal. It's that we know deep in our heart that we want to do something, but we're afraid to attempt it. What happened? What does it say about us if we go all in and we fail? And he says the scariest thing, I think the direct quote from him was, the scariest thing is admitting to yourself, I want that, and then going for it. And his whole point, the reason he's telling this audience, a lot of young kids in the audience, is you have to overcome that fear. If you've identified this is what you want to do in life, this is what you want your life to be, you have to go forward no matter what. And we see her she's admitting that she loves the newspaper industry. But again, she's just been brainwashed that it's just not in the cards for her because she was born female. I think I want to go into the newspaper business. The fact remains that what I am most interested in doing is reporting, possibly working up to political reporting later. As you can see, this is no help to Dad. He wants and needs someone who is willing to go through the whole mill. So they're talking about the reason he winds up passing down the paper to Phil Graham. Is because, they can take care of circulation and management problems and run the actual business and deal with the editorials and the politicians and everything else. And she's saying, well, I just have a love of reporting. And then this is what she says here. Again, if you have a feeling like this, the way she feels in this next sentence, if Phil Graham never killed himself, she would have never had the career that she had, right? Which is the single most tragic thing that ever happened to her. But in a weird way, and I hate to say it like this, it might be the best thing that ever happened. Phil has some serious problems, manic depression. He was extremely troubled, but he also was not, I don't know if she would agree with this statement, but reading this book, he was not a good husband. He would belittle her. He cheated on her. 6 months before he kills himself, he leaves her for his employee. And then he admits to her in one of his, it's almost like what we see. He has these rants which is like, oh yeah, it's not just Robin, which is his mistress. It's like, you know, it's this person. She didn't know any of this, and he was just carrying on all these relationships. He was good friends with JFK. He had a lot of JFK in him, actually, is the way I would put it, because JFK was doing the same things to Jackie Kennedy. But this is the sentence. I doubt my ability to carry a load like the Washington Post. From Dad's point of view, I think it would mean something. I may be flattering myself, but I think it would mean several things, such as companionship, a living connection with the next generation, and the knowledge that that all that he was slaving to build was not going to stop. And she's talking about it would mean a lot to Dad if I had the ability to do this. She's not married yet, so she doesn't know that you know, her husband's going to be the one fulfilling this position where she's saying the one that she's talking about that secretly she probably really wants, but she doesn't feel she's good enough for. And that's what he wanted the Washington Post to be, a family business. Eventually they go public, but Warren Buffett writes her a letter when he invests before they have a relationship. He buys like 10% of the company. He's like, listen, I'm fine that it's Graham run and Graham own, meaning Graham family, and Graham managed. I'm fine with that. So he says, and the knowledge that he was not slaving to build something that was not going to stop with him. From my point of view, it would be giving up a position that is fair to say thousands would fight for. That is an influential position and an influential paper in the capital of the world's most important country. If I find for some reason that I'm not fitted to the newspaper work, and this may happen among other things, I function a little on the slow side. She's so demeaning to herself. She's called herself ugly, doesn't think she's motivated enough. Now she's saying she's not smart enough. I function a little on the slow side, which is not good. I shall get out and consider it no disgrace. And so I would just stop and think about what she just said there. Like, she would consider it no disgrace. So this is something that she wants to do, something that she doesn't think she can do, something that would be good for her family, yet saying that if it didn't happen, it'd be no disgrace. I don't know if I agree with that. If we only have one shot at life, isn't it a disgrace to not actually do what you truly want to do? Thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you want to continue listening to the full episode, you'll need to upgrade to the Misfit feed. By upgrading, you'll get access to every full episode that I've ever done. These episodes are available nowhere else. And as a bonus, you also get lifetime access to my notebook that contains key insights from over 285 podcasts and lectures on entrepreneurship. As a way to illustrate why it is so important for you to learn the lessons from all the biographies that I analyze on the Misfit feed, I have some quotes that I've collected from other people who have discovered the value in reading biographies, and they explain to you and I why this activity is so valuable. So the first quote comes from the founder of Shopify, Toby Lütke, and he says, "Books are the closest you will ever come to finding cheat codes for real life. You can access the entire learnings of someone else's career in a few hours." This quote from Mark Andreessen on why he reads biographies. There are thousands of years in history in which lots and lots of very smart people worked very hard and ran all types of experiments on how to create new businesses and invent new technology. They ran these experiments throughout their entire lives. At some point, somebody put these ideas down in a book. For very little money and a few hours of time, you can learn from someone's accumulated experience. There is so much more to learn from the past than we often realize. You could productively spend your time reading experiences of great people who have come before you and learn every time. And finally, this quote from the book, The Tao of Charlie Munger, on why Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett have both read hundreds of biographies in their lifetime. Reading personal biographies allows one to experience multiple lives and successes and failures. Reading business biographies allows one to experience the vicissitudes of a business and learn how problems were solved. Both Charlie and Warren are copious readers of personal and business biographies. So upgrade now by tapping the link that's in your show notes on your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com.